Michael Newman is an Australian adult educator who has many years of experience in the practice and theory of adult community and trade union education. In the 1960s, he left Australia for the UK, where he set up and taught adult education classes before working for 7 years as a community education worker in Inner London. In the early 80s, Mike was invited back to Australia to head up the Sydney Workers Educational Association. He then left the WEA to work for 4 years as a trainer with the Australian Trade Union Training Authority, and in 1989 took up a post as Senior Lecturer in Adult Education in the Faculty of Education at the University of Technology, Sydney. Michael has written 4 books on adult education. His latest book is Teaching Defiance, Stories and Strategies for Activist Educators. His 3 earlier books are available for download from his website, www.michaelnewman.info. Although Michael retired from his university position in 2001, he continues to deliver occasional workshops on activism and learning for unions and activist organisations. In November 2009, Michael gave 2 addresses to the Trans-Tasman Union Educators Conference. The first was on the 9 aspects he believes are present in good learning.
Well, a few familiar faces. G'day. Every time I do this, which is less and less often, I get there's a kind of inverse proportion. My nerves get higher and higher. It is 20 years, more than 20 years, since I worked full time for a union organisation. So I keep saying this to Jane Clark, who hounds me with emails over a long period of time, and finally I cave in, and once I've agreed to it, she then extends the period of time by 10 minutes. So Sarah. Thank you for mentioning Tutor. It was the most wonderful period of my life working for the Trade Union Training Authority, and I would not have left. But I received a telephone call from a comrade one day from Melbourne saying, Mike, I think you better begin looking for another job. Why is that? I said, well, he said, every time your name is mentioned, the national director's lips thin and he takes on a kind of baleful stare, and my suggestion is your future is not secure, which is the reason I applied for a job at a university and by some miracle was allowed in under the net without particularly appropriate qualifications. Now, all of this is not just me burbling on about my background and my history, but it's to sort of indicate that I'm so far away from day-to-day association with the union movement that I daren't really make too many references to unions, and I daren't make too many references to union training. So then I wandered off into this sort of la-di-da, sort of wanker academic world, which is what my old comrades from Tutor still describe me as when we go for lunch. Ah, here comes the wanker academic, they say. So I've kind of decided to be academic this morning and talk sort of theory. And I want to take the position of saying that from my memory, we talked a lot about training and teaching, but we didn't always spend that much time talking about learning, about what was actually going on in the minds and the bodies of the people who are in the training room with us. So I'm taking a risk, and bear with me, and if the risk is a failure, just be nice to me during coffee break, really, don't you? Okay, look, I make one point for the entire morning, and that I believe that good learning has 9 different aspects. Learning isn't something that can be broken up into different kinds of learning. I think that in all the learning theory is a furphy. I think the word learning has been around in the language for long enough for us to assume that it is a single event, a single act, but that it has a range of different aspects, and that when all the aspects are there in the one act of learning, you have really good learning. So my proposal for this morning is to define what I think is good learning. So I have listed the 9 aspects. I don't have any PowerPoints or anything here. Something pretty pathetic. Paper. Okay, has everybody got a sheet of paper with 9 obscure words on it? Okay, those are my 9 aspects. I reckon that really good learning has all of those 9 aspects in it. I'm not suggesting that any piece of learning will have all those aspects in equal amounts. In fact, clearly one or other of the aspects will dominate, or will quite often dominate. Tremendous amount of the training that I did in tutor in the 1980s was instrumental. We weren't really allowed to do anything political. Of course we did, but we weren't meant to. So it all had to be couched in instrumental styles, training people to perform roles, training people in the skills of negotiation. And it would only be sort of in the late evening or somewhere where somebody would say, look, hang on, can you explain the difference between socialism and social democracy? And we'd sort of look uneasily because the law, the act, said we weren't meant to do this, and somebody would close the door and say, really want to know? Right, if they asked me that, I would say, go and get Phil Drew. He's better than me on that. All right, so I'd like you to talk in your threes or your pairs and look through that list and wonder aloud amongst yourselves what they might mean. And they don't come in any particular order, so when you've had a sort of look through and think what some of them might mean, then somebody might like to ask me to explain one or other of them. And that's the way we'll do the morning. I shall explain, if I can. When we've covered all 9 of them, or somebody rings a bell, or that alarm goes, I'm really frightened about that, we'll go for coffee. So if you're disappointed, you can go now. Okay, some of these terms occur in the literature, and some of these... Is that better, Jill? Yeah, sorry. Some of these terms occur in the literature, and I've used them in roughly that way, but sometimes I've given them my own meaning. So I'm open to questions. Would somebody like me to explain what on earth I mean by one of these words?
Essential.
Ah, you choose the most difficult one first. What's your name? No, but that's fair enough, because I don't see these in order. It's kind of like a circle of things. Really good learning has somewhere in it an attempt to come to grips with the essence of things. I mean, if I'm going to be philosophical and I talk about the existentialist philosophers, they really broke the world into 2 things, existence and essence. And they argued that existence came first and essence came second, and essence for them was constructing a theory out of existence, a theory about out of what what existed. So, I mean, Jean-Paul Sartre said, we are born into existence and we encounter ourselves as we surge up through life and we define ourselves afterwards. So essence is the idea of some kind of deep and central meaning to an experience or to an event or to an object. If I come away from that la-di-da stuff, it's something that happens, the perception of the essence in appreciating the arts, for example. I stand in front of a painting. I've just been in the States and went to the Art Institute in Chicago, and I stood in front of a painting by Chagall. And it happens not every day of the week, but every now and again a painting grabs me and I look at it and it begins to take on a depth and it begins to take on a shape, and to my surprise it's not what I first looked at. It changes in appearance and so on. I begin to sense something behind the painting, something inside the painting. I begin to have a relationship with the essence of that painting. And really good teaching and learning encourages people to sort of understand the sort of non-explicable essence of things. So you've asked me to start with an element of learning which is non-rational. But really, really good learning has these sort of little flashes of light, these moments of the non-rational, where you feel better or you feel you understand something and you can't explain. It's like, and another word that we might use is insight. And we can't teach insight, but we can set up a bloody good role play in the vague hope that somewhere in the course of that, some people may have an insight. And an insight is a realization of the conclusion without the foregoing argument. There is no argument, but suddenly you just have the conclusion. It is an understanding without you being able to explain how you came by that understanding. It's an experience you might have when you're bushwalking. And suddenly, instead of relating on a sort of one-to-one relationship with the bush, you know, there's a tree over there, suddenly you're encased in an entire globe and you are sort of both part of it. And without being able to explain it, you understand it. So I mean, you asked me to start with the absolute. But there is something that happens in learning where we abandon logic and we arrive at a conclusion without having gone through the preceding argument. We experience insight. So, I mean, we understand a painting, or we understand our partner, or we understand an idea. We understand ourselves without being able to explain the understanding. I mean, is that what we mean when, after having worked in all sorts of other jobs, we end up full-time or fully committed within a union and comprehend solidarity without being able to understand what it is? Or just feel it? At this moment, I am at one with my comrades and my own personal self-interests have been abandoned. That I will stand by this person next to me as I know she will stand next to me without the slightest regard for her own personal self-interest. And I just feel that. So the essential aspect of learning is about leaving room for just the essence of things to come forward. We can engage actively as teachers in helping that learning take place by helping people give significance to moments of existence. In other words, we help them give the essence to the existence. By getting them to understand the moment as symbolic. Within the Union movement, the stonemasons' march in 1848 has taken on a supreme symbolism. At the time when they were marching, they didn't know they were going to become a supreme symbol. They were just after eight bob a day. But it's taken on a symbolic importance, and we have made that event part of the essence of being in the Union movement. And so we can encourage our learners to create their own stories, in a sense, but to create their own myths, to create their own legends. So just recently I was delighted to see a wonderful myth, legend, true story probably, of Bob Hawke's encounter as president of the ACTU with Frank Sinatra. Did you read that? Frank Sinatra, in his first show in Melbourne, spoke belittlingly of the journalists. I briefly was a journalist, a member of the Australian Journalists Association. I was outraged. Everybody was outraged. The journos went to the ACTU, and the ACTU slapped a ban on Frank Sinatra. You know, that's a wonderful story. And he couldn't get out of Melbourne. He couldn't get any transport out of Melbourne. And so he was stuck, fulminating. And then Bob Hawke went to him, and, you know, our glorious leader, the negotiator solved the problem. No, that's, I'm sorry. It's part of the myth. Anyway, that's what I mean, whatever I said, about essence, essential learning. Instrumental, yeah. Oh, no, thank you, yes. Often maligned, instrumental, yeah. Tremendous, as I said, I think a tremendous amount of Union training, at least when I was sort of back there then, was instrumental rather than ideological. instrumental is about learning skills and tasks. It's about learning to plough the fields and to build dams and to forge steel and to crush grapes. I mean, it's pretty clear. Actually, it's about taking control of things. Instrumental learning is actually about learning how to take control of things, and it is a driving human need to take control of our environment, according to Jürgen Habermas, German philosopher. One of the driving human needs is to take control of our environment. So this is about taking control and turning that environment to our purpose. So this is helping our members manage the physical world, the technological world. This is not simple learning. This is highly complex and sophisticated learning, because they're learning to take control of the physical world, the technological world, all the world that science has given us, and the social and the economic and the legal and political worlds. See, the clue to it being instrumental is that the environment is perceived as inanimate. If it's instrumental, the environment is there to be managed. And so this can involve other people. If I perceive the people as inanimate, as units in an organisation. So if you have a look at a lot of management theory, actually, deep inside all of the talk about care and concern for the employees, etc., etc., the actual way in which it's written perceives these people as inanimate parts of the environment. If you say this, they will do that. If you use this particular model, this will happen. And we're guilty of it too when we teach problem-solving models. Sometimes we teach problem-solving models which apparently are about getting people to talk to each other, but really are about getting people to follow through a series of steps. And we are, if we're honest with ourselves, really treating them as part of an inanimate environment that we can take control of. Yeah. I'll have a break again, is that true? You can talk for a minute and I'll have a sip of water, is it true? Can't be true. Is this okay if I do it like this? If you stop asking me questions, I'll just go through them one by one and you can all fall asleep. So do I have another one that you'd... Oh, moral. Yes, I mean, it's always difficult. You talk about moral and people immediately think you're going to sort of shove something down their throat. You know, I shall shove peace down your bloodthirsty throat sort of idea. You must take on my views. But that's not the case. I would leave that for the critical and political aspects of learning. But I think that in which I will tell people... But I think that really good learning has a moral element to it. And by that I mean that it involves an opportunity for the learners to give some thought about what is good and what is bad, what is right and what is wrong. And it's not that I'm going to tell them what is, but that they come to grips with the fact that they do have a morality, whether they're aware of it or not, and a moral code. And they do make judgments about things that they are good or that they're bad or that they're right and that they're wrong. And I think at the same time we have a duty in a sense to say, look, what you think is right may well not be for someone else. Because morality, actually, when one examines it closely, is relative. Very often relative. So that the inviolate nature of childhood in our society is not necessarily shared in some other societies where a girl as young as 9 can be given in marriage. And this is active sexual marriage to a mature person, to a mature man. So it's necessary to say, look, you know, that just necessarily isn't right, what you think is. It may well be. But what you need to do is to think through the reasons behind your moral stand. And I think that we can help our learners subject their moral code to scrutiny. In a sense, it's like saying, take out your conscience, right? Pull it out and have a look at it. And where the bloody hell did this come from? I feel good and I feel bad and I feel ashamed and I feel pleased for a variety of reasons being operated by this mechanism called the conscience. And where did it come from? Did it come from my dad and my mum, or did it come from my upbringing? And now that I've thought about it, it does come from somewhere. So is it working well? And perhaps I should look back through some decisions I've made in the past and say, well, you know, they seem to be right at the time, but that was according to this conscience, which I'm now having a good look at just to make sure that I've got something that works well here. So it's that process. And how do I do it as a trainer? The only way that I can think one can do it as a trainer is by telling stories, and you remember one. By telling stories where people are faced with moral dilemmas and the right and the wrong is not so bloody clear, and then getting people to talk it out and say, well, you know, what would you have done in that particular case? And I can't tell the story in detail of Gordon, but it involved a union official in North Pakistan fighting against child labour in the brick kilns in North Pakistan. And in the process of the fight, they were having some real troubles and beginning to lose. They'd set up a school for kids who were in slave labour and enforced their attendance at school, breaking the sort of cycle of child labour these kids were in. But then the kids from one of the brick kilns disappeared and were moved away by the owner because they were kind of like slaves. And Gordon, our mates, Pakistani colleagues, kidnapped the son of the kiln owner. And so Gordon was in the middle of this morally complex business of, you know, I mean, after all, beyond murder and rape, the most devastating removal of human rights must surely be kidnapping. And they sent the kiln owner a letter. And this is Gordon looking at his mates, his comrades. suddenly they're kidnapping people. And they wrote to the kiln owner saying, we won't harm your son, but you'll never see him again. They didn't say if or anything, just that's it, finish of story. And the children who'd been moved reappeared and the child was returned. Now it's an interesting case. I mean, you're against violence, aren't you? And you're against the removal of a person's human rights. Of course you are. But whose human rights are we talking about? The kids in child labour or the child of the kiln owner? Not easy. How does your conscience, which you've got out here, it's a bit flabby in your hand at the moment because having some trouble dealing with this. Well, these, and there are lots of stories, these are stories you can tell. Because one of the unfortunate truths is that it's quite often only when action is escalated to violence that people really take notice. Yet you're against violence, aren't you? So, this is about understanding what doing our best might mean and then trying to put that best into practice. Got another one? Affective. There are two aspects concerned with emotion, so I'll talk about both of them maybe. Again, you know, in union training, we're a bit sort of worried about the fact that we get in people without a union background into the training organisation. They've come from some sort of dreadful adult education background. And there's just the possibility they'll want us all to hold hands or something. Or maybe turn out the lights and, you know. I mean, we don't do that in the metal workers. But in fact, a key aspect to learning is the effective learning, and that is, yes, it's about emotions. It's actually about how we react in relationships. This is not communicative learning. This is sort of looking at how we emotionally react in different kinds of relationships, and it's about understanding what emotions are. Often, things that go unexamined. The range of emotions open to us and how to manage and control them, how to simulate them. And if you're in an active context, there will be times when you will have to simulate emotions, and it's worthwhile studying emotions a bit, because if you're going to simulate sudden flash of rage to scare the hell out of the people on the other side of the negotiating table, it better be convincing. It better be well simulated. And we will often simulate a pleasing, queasy-mouthed kind of friendship with the management, because for a while that will be suit our purposes. So, yeah, it's about understanding and thinking about emotions, but it's really, that's a simple way of saying, thinking about how people relate. And it's also about learning how to respond to our own emotions so that we're not taken suddenly against our guard in some context where perhaps the interests of another 400 people depend upon our reactions. So it's about that, and it's also about how to respond to the emotion of others. You know, your federal secretary may need to be pleased a bit and allowed to maintain his or her sense of pride and authority. So might be worth studying how you respond. There are some people laughing, others just not at all. This is a phrase that I like. It's about bringing the way we feel to the way we think, so that our thinking is broadened out by an examination of the emotions in that thinking. So bringing the way we feel to the way we think. Understanding how emotions can actually provide a balance to the way we respond to our social and material worlds. So I've put effective there. That's about understanding emotions, but I've also put passionate. And that's about emotions again, but this is taking some time with ourselves and our learners to understand the dangerous emotions that can overwhelm us and overwhelm others. And it's about how we might use these dangerous emotions like anger and rage and hatred, and seeing these emotions as potentially positive forces providing us with motives for action. So rage and anger and hatred. And if I'm still allowed to this afternoon over drinks, I will spend much more time on rage and hatred. It's much better to do with a glass of wine in your hand. Look, it's seeing strong emotion as positive forces. So the passionate aspect of learning is about using emotion, so that we get people to understand the power of the emotion of love, but it may be love of an ideal, and it may be love of your comrades. But we use it positively and not negatively. We love, but we do not smother. We hate. And look, we would simply not be human if we did not hate, because there are things in this world that are hateful. We would be only half conscious if we did not have hate. And I use the word hate rather than hatred, because hatred's more abstract. No, that's that burning thing that gets at you and grinds at your guts and makes you bubble with rage. But we hate the warmonger, the drug lord, the oppressor, the boss that ignores safety. And we maintain our anger at cruelty and injustice, and not just at those abstracts, but at the people who are cruel, the people who are unjust. So really good learning has an aspect of those strong and powerful emotions. I mean, one of the ways to look at that issue of politics is to, I mean, you've got to be careful about this, but essentially to say, look, if somebody has been fool enough to employ me and given me the authority to do this training, and if these people are mug enough to stay, I would be a fool not to try and make them think like me. Which is precisely what I'm doing this morning. With, of course, as I mentioned, the lack of pay. Right? So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of glib, but it's not so glib. What really I loved about training in the union movement was that I did not have to be balanced. I did not have to be academically detached. I did not have to be objective. My job was to get those people in that room better able to go out and screw the bosses. And I know that we had, you know, all those consultative processes in the late 80s and all of that sort of thing, and that was very distressing for me because we had to sort of teach these things, like working on consultative committees. But I would say if you go under consultative committee, you're still representing the union and your members, and it's one-sided stuff, and one-sided education is powerful stuff. And why should I give my time over to putting the other case, the other point of view? Let them do it. And if as long as in the course of my training I do not coerce people, as long as I allow ample time for them to reply and to mount counter-arguments, so I'm not dealing with children, I'm dealing with fellow adults here, so as long as I allow them counter time, and as long as I make sure that they are free to leave at any time, then I don't think it can be described as propaganda at all, no matter how one-sided. So that's kind of the idea. Yeah. Is that done the political? Well, but I've got here about a critical and political. Can I just run through those two? How are we going? 5 minutes. I like the idea of, and these are actually sort of quite, well, they're associated, all three, interpretive, critical and political. But I see them as useful to maintain them as different aspects in my mind. And I've put interpretive because a lot of learning is about actually focusing on oneself and the people in the room with you and in a sense interpreting the human condition. The human condition is fairly complex and it's interpreting it, trying to form an opinion of what being human might be. And about sort of getting people to understand that it's, you know, why not make use of the opportunity of being alive, in a sense. Think about being alive. Think about being human. So this is that kind of learning where we encourage people to understand what makes them tick. And it's a bit the same with the conscience. It's the business of getting people to pause for a minute and say, look, you know, I find myself this human being at this age in this particular context. How did I come to be here? What were the kind of values that guided me here? Where did those values come from? What kind of attitudes do I express? What makes me tick? You know, what are my prejudices, my predilections, my doubts, my certainties, my weaknesses, my qualities? Because you see, if we learn to see through ourselves, we can learn to see through others. They're there at that age, in that job, in that position, saying those things because they have values. They picked up these kind of ideas. They were influenced in this particular way. They are under the thumb of someone, just the way I'm under the thumb of some set of ideas. So if I can see, if I can understand what makes me tick, and if I can help my learners to do it, they'll be able to understand what make other people tick. I mean, and if it's a fight, it's really useful. So it's about appreciating human experience in all its pettiness and all its magnificence and making sense of that experience. Remember, I'm talking about aspects of learning. I would say really good learning might have just the slightest little sliver of this, but it needs it for it to be really good learning. And from interpretive, I then go to critical, because critical is really the interpretive aspect But it's now, having adopted a continued and healthy scepticism, you know, people don't just act. They act because of their past. They act because of their beliefs. And I need to be continually sceptical of anything anyone says and anything anyone does. First off, I need to know whether they're being openly hypocritical or whether they're just being manipulated by their own past. They are trapped in their own history and continually reliving it. Why do we make the same mistakes again and again? Because we are trapped in our own history, continually reliving it. Why did I have the most demented of 4 years of appalling relationship with my teenage daughter, in which I would constantly say, that was a mistake, just shouting her out like that, not going to do that again, and then making the same mistake again. I was trapped in my own history. So being continually sceptical is a way of understanding that and looking at the histories and looking at the traps and getting people to escape from their own traps, getting them to think about that. It's about critical learning is about creating our own consciousness. Because once we develop this level of thinking, this level of scepticism, we reach a heightened state of consciousness. We see people in a different way. We think in a different way. We ourselves live in a different way. We are more or differently conscious. So it's about combating the influence and controls of others, of government, of advertising, of the union, of family, of peers. It's in a sense combating the Gramscian concept of hegemony, in which I find myself acting in the interests of somebody else. I find myself thinking that something is natural and normal and in need of no explanation when it is not natural, when it is not normal, and when it's in need of a bloody lot of explanation. Which the condition, the longevity, the health issues of our Indigenous people is just but one glaring and terrifying example. It is not natural, it is not normal, and it is in need of endless explanation until resolved. The critical aspect is about taking nothing for granted, nothing as given. And it's about acknowledging and welcoming contradictions and paradoxes and conflicts. And finally, critical. In the hands of the philosophers, a key element to critical theory, critical explanation, is an analysis of power. So understanding that all relations with your partner, with anyone, is an expression of power. And so that takes us from interpretive to critical to political, which I've touched upon a bit already, but the political aspect of learning is where we try and get ourselves and our learners to examine conflicts in order to make judgments. And if you make a judgment, you are required to take sides. So it's helping people understand what the context is, making the judgment, and then understanding that that judgment puts them on one side or another. And if we take sides, then we join with others to take action. So political The political aspect of learning is about critically analysing faiths and beliefs and ideologies and arguments and judging people and laying blame. Bugger it. Finding the person responsible and laying the blame. A lot of our society, we're a little bit too sort of squeamish about that. So we talk about a Gramscian hegemony. We are subject to a hegemonic control by big business. But no, those buggers have names and addresses and bank account numbers in Switzerland. It's about understanding the uses and misuses of power. So it's about learning for emancipation. Come here, you do this every day in your courses, I know. So that's into, I'm ticking them off. Got short amount of time left. What have I missed? Communicative. Oh, ye gods. Yeah. Have you been in those situations where people have used those communication skills on you? You know? And you think, I can't believe I'm hearing this. I say, listen, Mike, you know, when you do that, I feel... Well, I say, when you use one of those patterns, I want to kill you. Anyway, communicative is in one sense nice and easy, and it's the last one, is it? I can go. Great. It's about relationships, it's about language, it's about gesture, it's about image, it's about action, because we communicate in all sorts of ways, probably most powerfully through our actions. It's about, well, why not? It's about learning how to influence and persuade and cajole people. That's the business we're in. Cajoling, persuading somebody to actually join the union, and then persuading them to be something slightly more than a passive member. It's about learning how to manage and manipulate individuals and groups. I can try to manage a meeting from the floor of the meeting by having assessed whether the chair is up to it or not, by using the right kind of language, because there's the language of decision, we will do this. Right? There's the language of a solution to a problem. We should, or we ought to do this. There's the language of options, which is we could, or we can, do this. And there's the language of analysis, which is, are, was, were. So we discuss the facts of the matter using the language of analysis. There's a workforce of 27 people. The boss is a bugger. I'm using is. I'm analysing. I'm laying out the situation. The language of option. Once we've laid out the situation and seen the problem, then we can look at what we can do. A range of things that we can do. Or we can distance ourselves a little bit from it and we can use could. We could do that. But there are other things we can do. And then there's we ought to do this. We should do that. We're reaching a decision. And then we will do this. We've decided on action. Now I can be sitting in the middle of a meeting and I can hear that we are moving too quickly away from analysis. And I can say, yeah, of course we can do that. There are loads of things we could do. But is this the case? Shift back to the analysis phase by shifting the tense, the word, the verb I'm using. Or I can be tired to bloody death of people saying, oh, we can do this, and somebody saying, no, we can do that, no, we can do this, and we can do that. And I say, yeah, we can do all of those things, but I reckon we ought to. And I use the language of solution. Next time you're in a meeting, listen for the language that people around you are using. Some are consciously using that language to shift the meeting forward or back. Others do it naturally and instinctively. You think, what's happened here? How has the chair lost total control? It may actually be because the person who's sitting in the middle of the room, apparently saying very little, is really brilliant at communicative skills. So managing and manipulating individuals and groups, this is a real skill that we can teach. And communicative learning is about conveying grand ideas, and it's about gossip, it's about everything. And don't belittle gossip, because you will be able to judge whether your members are really a coherent group or whether they're just pretending to be a group if they gossip. Because gossip is a mark of closeness. You only gossip amongst yourselves about members of your own community. It may be malicious, but it is still a mark of community. So, do your members gossip? Because if they gossip, you're on good ground. It's about, obviously, negotiating, which we teach, teaching how we can collaborate, how we can form alliances, how we can engage in disputes, all using language. And I'll finish on this. Good point. I ended on a nice point, I think. I hope so, anyway. The community aspect of learning, forgive me, but I go back to the existentialists, is helping us and our learners combat our existential isolation. By that I mean that each and every one of us in this room is isolated. We're trapped inside our own consciousness. We're trapped inside our own awareness. We spend our lives trying to reach out and touch and draw other people into our consciousness, but it's an impossibility. We spend our lives trying to communicate with others from inside this sphere of our own awareness, but our communication will only ever be imperfect. So communicative aspect of learning is to counteract that isolation. Never succeed, but we can make that isolation less oppressive. We can help people understand that they do live in isolation, but it does not stop us engaging in solidarity with another person. So we can have some kind of communication. Perhaps that's why physical lovemaking is quite often so urgent, as the partners are desperately trying to enter each other, embrace each other, wrap the limbs around each other to combat this horrific isolation we are in. And what a tremendous thing for us as union educators to do, to help people combat that isolation, because we operate within a movement that actually provides company and provides common thinking and common understanding. And the last thing is, this communicative aspect of learning is about helping people break the silence and have a say in our world.
You've been listening to Michael Newman speaking at the 2009 Trans-Tasman Union Educators Conference, organised by the Australian Council of Trade Unions and the New Zealand Council of Trade Unions. The biographical information was sourced from www.michaelnewman.info. The music is Can We Speak by Wasseroo. This podcast was recorded and produced by Chris Walker. Many thanks to Michael Newman for his participation.